You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, you've joined The View. Today we're talking with some New Orleanians, Dee Van Diver and Quo Vadis Bro, and we're speaking about the Center for Ethical Living, Social Justice. Darn it, it's too long. Center for Ethical Living, Social Justice Renewal.
There you go.
And just a really wonderful center that Deanna now directs and Quo Vadis used to, where we have been living these past 10 years since the flood, since Katrina, since that, and living into values that were important long before that. So, Deanna, can you talk about, as the center's evolved, how you've seen the evolution of interest? Obviously, at first, it was the crisis of getting there to sheetrock, and you know, but just talk about how it's evolved. And Quo Vadis obviously can talk about the first 5 years, too, but what have you seen?
Sure. So August 29th was my three-year anniversary there at the center, and as I've talked to others, the first year continued, I think, what Quo Vadis will talk about, this sense of, we've got to rebuild houses, why are you making us talk about race? But the last 2 years, I think, especially as you pointed out before, the national dialogue is changing, I'm really lifting up the polite and less than polite white supremacy that is in the blanket that covers this nation. People have been coming here to engage with the center around, wait, how does systemic oppression, how does systemic and structural racism, how does that connect to service learning? What does it mean to show up as a volunteer? How do we do that faithfully and with integrity? So it's been a real gift to be able to be in this place at this time as people are starting to understand that they are in relationship with the center, that they are in relationship with New Orleans and the Gulf South, and that it's not just an inequitable power dynamic of coming to offer help, but in fact a human dynamic of being in a relationship where we depend on each other in ways that are easier to articulate once you come and spent time in community, once you've had a chance to, as your own collective group, whoever you are, coming together to really reflect together on how do we serve to undo the internalized racial oppression in each of us, white people, people of color. It's hard to live in this country and not have it be in our bones. So
So the center is a residential center and it's also a learning center. Can you describe it just a little bit? Where is it? Who's behind it? How did it come into being?
Sure. Quo Vadis can certainly speak to the birth story. Like Genesis, it has a few creation versions. But as I've come to it, the center is co-created by the three Unitarian Universalist congregations in the greater New Orleans area. And it is, right now it's housed in the second floor of the religious education wing at First Unitarian Universalist at Jefferson and Claiborne. Though if those of you who've seen our new video know we are looking to get into a more accessible space. We're trying to get to a place where people don't have to come upstairs and where we have a little more spread out room. Right now we have three dorm rooms that can sleep 54 people. Amazing hospitalitarian, Chef Amina Dada. Ruth Adakala is organizing manager, and Colleen Murphy, who had leadership in the liberal religious organization, is now the program coordinator at the center. So super excited.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is a great staff. And so people come and they spend a few days there and, you know, going to do something like that can be a transformative experience. It can also be kind of a poaching on other people's misery and feeling like you're the, Aisha calls it the savior industrial complex, which I hadn't heard and I love it. How do you mitigate against that? How do you work with white people and privileged people, economically privileged people, to not feel like they're coming in to save others? What do you do with that?
Right. So one of the questions that we ask at the very beginning is, you know, who here likes to help people? And almost everyone raises their hand. And then we ask, who here likes to ask other people for help? And I mean, it gets very quiet. Almost no hands go up. And so we talk about that power dynamic and what ideas we have about help that we have internalized within us, and how then do we plan to start to have an explicit conversation about that, so that if we are going to enter into a relationship with a community, that we do so in a mutually affirming and respectful way, where we understand that power has been arranged a certain way, right? And that if we're going to help without understanding that we're bringing our own internalized ideas about who needs stuff and what it means to be needy and or vulnerable, right? Because we all got ideas about that. And if we're going into work with people without looking at those, then we can do more harm than good. So that's our invitation always.
Yeah. Clovis Breaux, you were the director of this center for 5 years, and you've overcome your technical difficulties, and you're with us, and I'm so glad to welcome you as well. Can you describe the evolution of this movement as you've observed it? Both, I'm thinking particularly now of at the center, how it began, how it has evolved. If you see what kind of transformation you've seen, what kind of challenges, specifically at the center, and then I want to talk just a lot more about New Orleans in general.
The center has grown a lot with Deanna, and I'm so happy to say it's remained devoted to the same principles that were in place when we were all there together. And Deanna's grown the social justice arm of the work since she's been in place. We put a curriculum in place that we constantly worked and revised based on the things we learned from the volunteers who were coming in and from the community. So we ended up with something that was very alive. It wasn't just something that we put on paper and played with. We actually had to do it almost every week and every year for 800 to 1,000 volunteers. So we learned a lot about what worked and what didn't, what people could hear and what they couldn't hear. And I'm happy to say that Deanna has taken that work so much farther along.
Well, and she has, and I think the evolution of culture around acknowledging, you know, Houston, we have a problem here with racism. I was there at the beginning, and I remember the white people saying, we already had a workshop at our church. Why do we have to talk about it for 2 more hours, you know, as if, like, we got that. We took that class, you know. And then I did see that after people were in the community, that even for a day, they'd be like, maybe we need to talk a little bit. And like, even for one day, they'd be like, but then, you know, white superiority, white supremacy is so deep. How do you see, you know, now with Black Lives Matter and this movement that we're in, where a lot of things are a lot more visible, I'd say, to white people than they were when you were at the center, you know, even 5 years ago? How do you see that evolving? Because that's, I think, part of what Deanna's got to work with, is just a different time. How do you see the Black Lives Matters movement and the whole visibility of, you know, things like mass incarceration, police brutality, just the violence, the ceaseless violence? How do you see that shaping the city and the work that can be done now by the center, by partners, by other people? What are you seeing in Corvallis? Yeah.
It's always the same whenever you have historical occurrences as both Boone and Bain. I'm pleased that there are people photographing activity. This is something we didn't have. We didn't have people walking around, everybody walking around with a cell phone who could capture things on video. Not that these things weren't happening, because they were happening. But now, not only is that true, but everybody is a journalist. So you can post whatever it is you've taken a picture of or taken a video of anywhere online and make it very public. So that's Boone. What's Bane is that these things are still going on. But I think the attention brought can only be good, and people who are inclined toward humanity will take notice and do something. People who are not are going to remain wherever they are. They're going to tear up Black Lives Matter signs, Bob, that you have to end up replacing. over and over because they don't see the need for making that kind of a distinction.
So let's talk a little bit about like how to put a race lens on what we see 10 years later. So I was looking at some of Bill Quigley, he did a blog at the Huffington Post.
Yes, yes.
With some numbers that, 59% of New Orleans is now black. It was 66.7, 31% white. It was 26%. That rent is way up, that there's significantly less public housing. I remember when they tore down that public housing unit for absolutely no reason, that was not damaged, and they just were like, yes, quick, it's our moment. At least that's certainly how it looked. And then, well, we could talk about jobs. We could talk about schools. There's so many things, I think, that New Orleans could show us about who still has not received any healing after the storm, that in many cases already conditions were there before the storm. But what would you say is that, you know, when you look at New Orleans now, what would you say is boon and bane? I like that, because it looks like some of the police, the incarceration statistics are better. There are fewer people now in jail in New Orleans. But I mean, how do you read the tea leaves on all of this? I'd love to hear from both of you about that.
Deanna? Well, I think, again, using the Boone and Bain model, there's some wonderful things happening. There is a kind of energy in the city around creative efforts and entrepreneurial efforts that may be, I won't say wasn't here before, but it's encouraging, having gone through the years of darkness and near darkness post-Katrina, to see the kind of energy that's afloat in the city. It's discouraging, however, to realize how many people who would love to be home were both priced out of the market and had to remain where they were. There's several different reasons why. Some people had children who were school age and needed to stay where they were until their children were finished with school. But some other people really would like to come back home, and where maybe they could have gotten a carriage apartment for $350, $450 a month pre-Katrina. Now that very carriage apartment is being marketed as something wonderful and special, and $850 a month. So you match that with where wages are in the city and look at who's in the service industry here in the city, and you don't have to do much to get the math straight. You know who's being locked out of the city. And the interesting thing is, and this was one of our fears from the beginning, is it's the very people who in fact create the culture that's so touted all over the world. So you're going to keep the culture creators out of the city. And then what does that leave you with? Because tourism is still going to be the major industry. So who's going to bring that culture? And what is what you're calling that culture going to be?
And what do you think of the people who say, you know, that there are forces that would like to Disneyize that culture and turn it into something that they can sell a little more easily? Do you see that happening?
I see some effort in that direction, but I do believe that in keeping with the resilience of people from New Orleans, there will be people always who are going to refuse to let that happen, even if it means they're sleeping in doorways instead of real apartments or real houses. Because this place has more, people are just more attached to place here than in most other places I've seen or lived in. And I don't know how long that will be before those people really manage to come back at the level that we need them to, because we have a population number, but it doesn't represent people who have returned to the city.
Right. So some of the people who are there now were not there before.
They were not. And that's not bad, Meg. That's a good thing. Right. There's lots of room for everybody. And I've said that every time I talk to volunteers. You want to come live in New Orleans? It's a lovely place to live.
Yeah.
Not in the dead of summer, but it's a good place.
It's a winter fantasy of mine, I'll admit, up here in Minnesota on the other end of that river, yeah.
Yeah, and but there was room for everybody. Pre-Katrina, our population had decreased, but our numbers had been well over 500,000 for years. So there was room for an influx. But the trouble I have with the influx is how gentrified things have become and how many people have been left out of the mix.
Yeah. Deanna, do you want to respond to that question as well? Do you have anything to add?
Just pointing out, you know, in terms of, as Quivadas lifted up, the people who've been left out of the mix, you know, we're looking at, when you look at the pre-flood population and now, almost 100,000 black people aren't back home. And there's lots of reasons for that, and one of them is, you know, systemic racism. I mean, they were, the politicians after the flood were really clear that this is our chance to knock out affordable housing. This is our chance to really go in and take over. I mean, over almost 7,500 New Orleans school teachers were just fired out of fire.
Let's pause and talk about the schools. Because I was reading that there are 44 school boards now in New Orleans, that 91% of the schools are charter schools, and that only 32% of African Americans think this is a better system. So can you say more about what's behind those statistics?
Want me? Sure. I'll start. Quivadas certainly add in, but you know, way back in the day when I was at McAllister College in Minnesota, Meg, we talked about charter schools and how when you bring them into a system, if you have like 10 to 12% of your system as charter school, then you've introduced the flexibility that you need in a school system, but any more than that, and you lose accountability, you lose systemic efficiency, you lose an ability to call people in. There's no way any person can go to 44 board meetings, especially when they're not super publicized, right? There's not a way to hold people accountable, and they're quasi privatized, almost all of them. And so, those boards.
Can you say what you mean by quasi privatized?
Quivadas, do you want to speak to it?
Well, they can be more selective in who gets in and how they treat them once they're in.
Again, that's legal for charter schools too.
If you don't have that kind of accountability, then you have something else happening in terms of an across-the-board disciplinary effort, because each school has its own policy. So you have all these mixed policies, and there isn't that level of systemic accountability. And frankly, I find that very frightening. And I think most, and I don't have school-aged children, but I do have grandchildren, not in this city, and I certainly wouldn't want to see them in this city suffering through a system like that, where initially children weren't even having recess. Because again, each school has its own set of policies. And then there were children being taken out, a few over the years in handcuffs because they were unruly. Well, my goodness, how can you expect children to sit all day still and not have a break and not end up unruly?
Well, and of course the statistics on who is actually taken out in handcuffs are highly racialized in every city.
Yes.
So, yes, exactly.
This is Bob, and I have done a lot of work in charter schools. I worked in one of the original charter schools in Massachusetts in 1995, and the distance from the vision to where we are now is so disappointing. Mm-hmm. But believe it, you know, if you don't want a kid in your charter school, you can get them out.
That's it.
You know, and there's just a million, you can counsel them out, you can just make their parents uncomfortable, there's a million things you can do informally. I saw it, you know, and there is no accountability on so many levels. And I was the director of finance and operations at a charter school, and the reporting requirements are so minimal, and there's so much you can do behind a set of books.
Yes.
It's really a massive transfer of public wealth to private hands.
Yep.
And there are people who are doing great things in some charter schools, but a lot of it, and I'm actually really interested in hearing your opinion about this, because a lot of it to me is feels, this is, I'm going to use really strong terms here, but it feels a bit like cultural genocide. Like there's really an attempt to impose a white culture, you know, and stamp those kids of color into that culture. No respect for where they're coming from or what their experience is. I'll stop my rant now, but I'd love to hear from both y'all in New Orleans about that.
Clovis?
Well, here's what I have to say about cultural genocide. It didn't just start. We know that, Bob. The schools are yet another symptom of the issue and all the attempts. But I tell you something, there's something about African peoples and a refusal to assimilate that is incredible. And New Orleans is, in fact, one of the best examples in the country of such incredible African cultural retentions. And even though many of those people are not here, the people who are here are very strong, they're very resilient, very culture conscious, and they're not going to give that over. That doesn't make it sound good, now does it, Deanna? Because then what happens to them in this setting?
Right. You know, in fact, with Gulf South Rising, we're really talking about shifting from even using the language of resilience to resistance. Because what we have here in New Orleans and in the Gulf South is a culture of resistance to being stamped out. One of my favorite tweets recently was someone saying, you know, if you moved here for the culture, stop calling the cops on the culture. Right?
Like, yes.
Staying here to hear live creative music, stop calling the cops when you hear it after 8 p.m., right? Because if you move to be near it, don't kill it. And I definitely think that that is what's happening in a lot of the systems here between education. There was a transportation report that just came out, and I think less than 36% of the bus lines have been restored in 10 years in a city that was heavily dependent on public transportation before the storm and now. But over 90% of the streetcar lines, you know, that go through the heavily white areas are restored, and they're building a new one out, you know, and dispossessing and displacing a whole nother community, basically, that's becoming gentrified down along St. Claude. So the systemic pieces are definitely pointed towards, you know, bringing in, whitewashing, Bob, I think is a word that you had used earlier in the conversation. There's a lot of that that's happening in this way. And just to lift up, I understand that the intentions of the people on the front lines and the charter schools are beautiful intentions. But we can't afford to look at intentions. We have to look at impacts. And the impacts of what's happening with these school systems is that children are being pushed out of school. They do their count early on, and then they get their money. So once they get their money, they don't need the kids in there. In fact, they actively need them out before that standardized test, because that will decide how much more money they get for the next school year, right? How they're doing in terms of the reporting. So the very system is set up to dehumanize children and the teachers and the administrators, right? Because if you're looking at sustaining your institution, and this is how you get funded, right? And so we are mad at the systemic oppression.
Well, and it's so interesting how the jobs and the schools come together, because they eliminated union jobs, right? They eliminated decent pay. And I was reading that 39% of the kids live in poverty, and 82% of those families, there are people working. It's just the wages are bad. And so that attack on the union and the attack on the schools, I mean, it's something that I believe is going to be tried in cities near us, all of us. I think it's happening. I think it's like the privatization of healthcare. It's a movement, the political movement going on, because there's a lot of money there to be had, right? So what I wonder, listening to all that, is are different kind of people elected to be, you know, the mayor and city council and stuff now in New Orleans than were, or where's the leadership? Where do you see the leadership on all levels? Community leadership, elected leadership. Where's that coming from?
I'll just say at Justice and Beyond, the coalition that the Center for Ethical Living and Social Justice Renewal organizes with, we're really looking at how you can be in accountable relationship with the community, So we invite our leadership in to come speak with us, and those who come are, you know, we're working with them, and those who will not speak, those who will not come, we are lifting up to the community that they're not working with, they're not being in relationship with New Orleans. And so really starting to organize around developing candidates, developing voter registration, moving polls back into precincts closer to people. So we're starting to organize to change what we are seeing as an unaccountable system. Quavadas, any thoughts?
No, I think what you're doing is great, but I'm concerned about the people who don't show up at your meetings. And I'm sure there are a lot of them. And the political system is the political system. And it seems it's operated that way for a long time. And it's so entrenched. And people think it's only New Orleans, but it really isn't only New Orleans. It's across the country. I mean, politics are politics, no matter where you are. But I'm concerned because there are enough people saying this doesn't work, but it doesn't seem to be changing anything. So that's just putting a question out there on the table. And I think you have to look at what you're doing with Justice and Beyond and all those other similar efforts in other cities and see how you can get more punch behind it. I don't know what you do, and that's what I'm asking. What do you do?
It's a good question. What would you both have wished if you ran the news? What would have been the headlines and the stories for you around the 10-year anniversary of the storm? What would you have wanted the world to know about the Gulf Coast in New Orleans 10 years later?
I really liked Bill Quigley's article, mostly because I really like looking at indices. I like looking at actual numbers to represent what's happening someplace. And he gave the numbers. He really talked about where we are. And so I saw some very effective things leading up to the 10th anniversary. And as I told you, even Sunday Morning Journal did an excellent story. I was disappointed because they did not cover education. So there's been a lot of good coverage. Deanna?
I would have wished for the Gulf South Rising coverage to have led in front of the, I would say, the whitewashing that a lot of the Katrina 10 stuff got. Definitely talking to frontline communities and not in a, oh, this awful thing happened, let's be emotional vampires around that, but in a, okay, how have you organized? What are you working to change? What kind of intersectionality and coalitions have, I mean, because from Florida to Texas now, we're organizing around climate change, bringing all of the intersections of racism, the patriarchy. I mean, we're looking at the whole of it and starting to talk in a way that, you know, we hadn't before. And I would really love for that to be lifted up and really love for people to talk to the frontline communities as experts and not just as witnesses. Oh, you saw this happen, but as people who, you know, if we're not paying attention to what's happening to frontline communities, soon you will be the frontline community, right? If Louisiana is gone, the hurricanes will go upriver. So that's one of the things I'd really wish had been lifted up a little more strongly.
Quavadas, your statement that social media would have made such a difference, I had never thought about what it would have been like if there had been so many news producers. Boy, it could have saved a lot of lives, I believe. Thank you for lifting that up. I just hadn't really put that piece into place. I'm wondering, Quavadas, starting with you, like you've been at this, you're clearly at it, you're going to stay at it, grandchildren are going to be at it. Where's your hope? Where do you see it? Where do you find it? What sustains you?
It's interesting, Meg, because somebody was, I think Elaine McArdle and I were talking about that with the article she did recently. And I was telling her, you know, I'm a realist. I look at what's really here. But I'm also a fatal optimist. I just really believe that humanity will prevail. I can't help but believe that. And I've seen many instances of genuine change and epiphany. And I used to tell people at the center, we're in the business of epiphanies. And we live for them. Change can happen genuinely, organically, and we can move forward. I believe it takes people who have the kind of fire in their belly, like Deanna, to help make it happen. But I think it can and will happen with enough forward motion in that direction. Now, when? Maybe not my lifetime. But I believe that the human animal is inclined toward resolution that reaches out toward humanity.
Amen. Or as the chant today says, I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. And I do. I do. And thank you. You just gave me some more of that belief. How about you, Deanna?
You know, I believe Unitarian Universalism, it points to, you know, our history of universal salvation. If we understand it today as collective liberation, if we get that as theological peace, that's what we're called to. I mean, I think so much is possible. I think as we become in relationship with each other, as we start to name where we've been isolated, I'm with Quo Vadis. I've been called a ruthless optimist, but I am committed to leaning into this community, and so grateful for everyone who's leaned in with us.
Thank you. I'm going to invite my very quiet co-panelists if there's anything they'd like to say as we move. Tom, you were just Tom Shade. And do say your name, just if you have any.
One of the things that I've seen is, you know, how a couple of articles talked about how what happened in Katrina laid some of the groundwork for the movement for Black Lives, that, you know, Kanye West kind of said it at the very beginning, you know, that the power structure doesn't care about Black Lives. And then I've been just thinking also about, like, here's this thing is so much bigger. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people leaving New Orleans and being displaced across the Gulf South mostly. Hundreds of thousands of volunteers from, like, church groups all over the United States, all over the Midwest, all over the country, coming down to New Orleans, witnessing what happened, and then returning back into their communities. We talk about how, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement may have changed how people see this, but also how all that activity and motion and contact that happened between 2005 and 2013 may have set some of that in motion and may have started something that we couldn't see. When I was down there in, you know, seven or I think it was 2007, and we spent some time in Mississippi, I was just amazed at, I mean, because there was this little church that was doing lunch for everybody, and there'd be hundreds of volunteers eating lunch at this little church in Mississippi, and they were from, you know, Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Dubuque, Iowa, and they'd be from some Catholic church in Buffalo. I mean, you know, there's hundreds of people down there, and I'm going, like, there must be thousands of people at any given time down here at this point, meeting people, seeing people, right? You know, they're bringing all their attitudes with, but they're also being changed by the experience in some osmosis and maybe given a picture into New Orleans and that culture of resistance, which has always been there. I love what you're saying, Quo Vadis, about, you know, the kind of resistance to assimilation that is there, and which is both incredibly attractive to people and terrifying to people too, right? Yeah. Especially yeah. Everybody who's, you know, has put away all their own ethnic and national stuff in the attic to assimilate into America, to see other people not assimilate and resist it. That's That's a thing. Anyway, enough for me. I was quiet for a long time, but now I'm talking too much. All right.
Thanks, Tom. Kovadis or Deanna, want to respond to that at all?
I'm deferring to Deanna.
I thank you for lifting up, Tom, just the how that we have gone out and people have come in and just the importance of bearing witness. And I think maybe not just by osmosis, but by relationship, right? I think the North and the South and particularly have had a lot of ideas about each other for a while, and to actually be in relationship with has really changed how people's world view. It always does, right?
I'm Aisha in Seattle. I want to jump in because I had long conversations at General Assembly with Reverend Nathan Ryan, who's also in Louisiana, but he's in Baton Rouge, I believe. And he had some really interesting observations about how Unitarian Universalism has a relationship or not with the South in general. We don't have many congregations in the South. I mean, I am so in awe, Deanna, of your of the program you're with, and I was just on your website, and we don't have enough of that. It feels like we still is. My disappointment in Unitarian Universalism as a whole is we talk a great talk, and something like, you know, what's happening right now on the Gulf Coast that continues to happen can be something we can meaningfully bring systemic change even within our association. And I don't see that happening, and I don't want to put a wet blanket. However, you know, we can't change something unless we name it. So this is, you know, Unitarian Universalism and Unitarian Universalists are part of the system. And what's our role, and how do we at least work with what we have to bring systemic change?
Yeah, I'll lift up the partnership that the center has with the College of Social Justice that we run every summer, where we are, this year it was called Activate New Orleans. It used to be called National Youth Justice Training. But that brings youth in from all over, and this year included a couple of local UU youth as well. And it really changed, you know, we go through the looking at systemic oppression and looking at our relationship, and also looking at Unitarian Universalist history and theology and connecting, really explicitly connecting the dots of where we've been and who and how we're called to be. So that's the work that we are committed to doing at the center, and I'm really happy to share that out with anyone else who wants to do that work. Ron Robinson of the Welcome Table in Oklahoma and to Queen of Boston, we've been talking about what would it look like to have these sites understood in our faith as a multi-site missional place, like that, you know, we have our faith exist missionally in these places and to understand us as a collective, you know, for our faith. So that's one of the places that we're starting to lean into.
Well, it's deeply inspiring. I feel some of the New Orleans strength even from talking to two of you. So makes me want to get back there again. Such an amazing place. It's kind of like leaving the U.S., really. I always feel like I'm in another country there in a really good way. So thank you so much, and I know you'll be keeping up the work. We'll keep checking back in, see how it's going, and I apologize for the technical difficulties. If you came early and you're here at the end, we'll cut this off of the podcast, but I'm sorry. So thank you to all of you who came, who stayed late, and see you next week on The View.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.